There we are. Right. Increasingly for undergraduate lectures, I've been recording them and sort of podcasting them. And of course, there's a challenge there. I've got to still make them interesting enough that people will still come along. But I'm finding that the combination of making the slides available via the internet plus the podcasts is quite useful. It's just audio. I figure, you know, you don't need to see me as long as you can see the slides, but sometimes it's very helpful to have the audio to back it up. It's entirely optional, of course. You know, you don't need to download these, but I figure it's something that you might find useful. And it's a wee experiment myself as well in the art of describing slides in a way that will still make sense when you listen to the audio podcast. It's no good, you know, just saying, over here you see such and such. You've got to see things like over in the left-hand corner and blah, 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 you know, so that in the absence of the visual pointers, it still makes sense. Okay, so what I'm going to do, just to get us up and running, is to go through a little series of images which indicate the sorts of things that Hubble has observed over these 18 years, and just mention very briefly some of the scientific results that have come from that. But of course, we'll develop all of these more fully over the 10 weeks. This is just a series of snapshots to get us started. And I'm going roughly in order from, you know, closest to furthest, and missing out a few other objects that were observed even closer to us than the planet Jupiter. In fact, Hubble has looked at the Moon, which has come up in a slightly different context. A topic that I've done a lot of public talks on in the last few years is the theme of the moon landings and whether they were faked or not. And something that people quite often hit me with is, say, well, can't we just use the Hubble telescope and look at the moon and surely we'll see the features in the moon? The fact is that even an astoundingly effective telescope like Hubble, if it were trained on the moon, as it has been, of course, you've got to take a very short exposure because the moon's relatively very bright compared with distant stars and galaxies. The smallest feature that Hubble can see is about 70 metres across. So for all it's, you know, an amazing telescope, there are limits. Nonetheless, Jupiter's a very big planet, and therefore if you look at the surface of Jupiter, of course, you know, most of the features you're seeing here, most of the ones like that little white blob down there, in the lower hemisphere, that's about the size of the Earth. So although we're seeing very fine detail, in terms of, you know, terrestrial distances and lengths, it's pretty big. But Hubble has been used to look at the Moon, I think just more for PR value than for any real science. It's been used to look at the planet Mars. There's been some very nice images of Mars. I've just, you know, taken Jupiter as my first stop. But next week, Alec McKinnon is in fact going to take the class. I'm at a conference, I'll say more about that in a few minutes. And Alec will be reviewing what Hubble has told us about the solar system. So he'll might even show you some of those lunar images taken with Hubble. I'm sure he'll show you this one, because Alec, his day job, so to speak, is working on trying to understand the energy that comes from the sun, to try to understand what we call solar flares, and the release of energy that comes from the sun's atmosphere, which actually can have quite a serious effect on the Earth. And it can cause striking, quite stunning displays of the northern lights. And that's when charged particles from the sun are hitting our atmosphere and causing the atmosphere to glow a little bit like the fluorescent lights that we see above us here. Now, the same thing happens on Jupiter.
How many people here have actually seen aurora?
That's worth asking. How many people here have seen aurora? Hopefully a few, but by no means everyone.
I was coming across the Atlantic in a plane, and it was definitely, I assume you can still see the height, obviously.
You can, yeah. In fact, it's easier to see the further north you are. So many of the transatlantic journeys you're taking quite far north of Britain on the way. Now, in the same way, and I don't want to go into this now, otherwise, you know, I've got lots of slides to go through tonight. See, the questions are very welcome, but forgive me if sometimes I say, ah, that's a great question, but we'll answer it in 4 weeks' time. But just to give you a brief, you know, to fill in a wee bit more about aurora, yes, I don't want to steal Alex's thunder for next week, but just as you would see the northern lights or the southern lights more dramatically the closer you are to the north or the south pole, in the same way the planet Jupiter has got a magnetic field, just like the Earth does, because that's essentially why the northern lights are so prominent close to the North Pole and the southern close to the South Pole, it's because the Earth's magnetic field is most bunched up close to the North and South Pole. Well, so too is Jupiter's. And what you're actually seeing here is Jupiter's northern lights, is the aurorae, as we call them, which is glowing gas in Jupiter's atmosphere, and it's glowing because of interactions between charged particles that are coming from the Sun and Jupiter's magnetic field. So it's a pretty stunning image anyway, but the great thing about Hubble, as we'll see a bit later, is that it's sensitive not just to the visible part of the spectrum that our eyes can see, it's also sensitive to ultraviolet light. Now our eyes can't see that, and moreover, our atmosphere shields the Earth from most of the ultraviolet light that comes from space. I mean, some gets through, that's why we have to wear sun cream when we're on the beach, but the ability to put a telescope above the atmosphere that could see in ultraviolet was one of the big driving forces behind the Hubble telescope project. And although this is a visual image, it's very much at the blue end of the spectrum, close to ultraviolet, and you can see the aurorae rather strikingly at those wavelengths, more so than at longer wavelengths. See, Alec will go into more of that next week. So even in our own solar system, on our own doorstep, Hubble has done some useful things. It's told us new things about the planets. Of course, we have the advantage for the planets that we can send space probes to visit the planets anyway. But Hubble has nonetheless still made a contribution. And at the edge of our solar system, I'm not allowed to call this one a planet anymore, but the planet Pluto, or dwarf planet as we now refer to it, was a great mystery when I was growing up. I mean, we knew hardly anything about it. It was discovered in 1930 by Clyde Tombaugh. The discovery that it had a moon was made, I think it was 1977. I was just really starting to get into astronomy then, and was quite excited to discover Pluto had a moon, but, you know, we couldn't image it really from the ground. The Hubble Faint Object Camera, that's what the FOC stands for, allowed us to get our first glimpse of what the surface of Pluto maybe looks like. And I know it doesn't look like much, but at least we can see that it's not a completely smooth, featureless globe. It's got bright patches and dark patches. Now, we'll learn a lot more, I forget the precise date, but there's a probe on the way there called Pluto Express. It's not actually getting there very fast, so it's not a well-named probe, but at the moment, this really is our best view of Pluto. And as you can see, that's not a very recent discovery. That was 1996. That was in the first few years after the satellite became fully operational. Moving a bit further out, here's our image that we saw before. Again, I'm going to devote several weeks to talking about what Hubble has told us about stars. So forgive me again if I scoot over the details tonight. This is just to whet your appetites. What you see here is a region where we believe stars are being born. And it's a very famous image. It's a gas cloud or nebula, which is known for many decades, indeed hundreds of years. The M16 denotes a catalogue compiled by a French astronomer called Charles Messier. So the Messier objects, there's more than 100 of them. And they come in a variety of shapes and sizes, quite literally. Some of them are whole galaxies. Others are individual stars or even the remnants of dead stars. This one is neither. It's a place where new stars are being born. And as I say, we'll talk lots more about that in a few weeks' time, because Hubble has helped us to understand the process of how stars form in a very remarkable way. Hubble's also told us about stars in their late stages of life. And this is a very famous star. It's Betelgeuse, which is one of the brightest stars in the sky. And this is just a cartoon drawing. It's not a real photograph. But you can see, superimposed in the cartoon drawing, you can see the outline of the constellation of Orion. I mean, is everyone familiar with Orion? Or, you know, maybe caught a glimpse of it as you go out on a winter's night, even in a city like Glasgow, there's a good chance you'll see at least Betelgeuse and Rigel, this one down here, and maybe the three stars of the belt. Well, despite what I said a few minutes ago, we were talking about the cross feature in the previous slide. I was saying that even with a big telescope, you still see a star as a point of light because they're so far away. That's not true for Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is so large that actually, with Hubble, it is possible to resolve the star as a sphere, as a disk. You see it as a disk in projection. And interestingly, we see that it's not a uniformly coloured sphere. This is, again, as I mentioned a moment ago, possible with Hubble because it's sensitive to ultraviolet light. Now, we'll get into a bit more of a discussion about light in its various forms later tonight and in subsequent weeks. But ultraviolet light is light that's got more energy than the visible light that we see with our eyes. In a way, that's why it's quite dangerous if you get exposed to too much ultraviolet light, because it can damage your skin, because the little packets of light energy called photons are more energetic than the photons of visible light coming from those lamps up there, for example. So when you look in the ultraviolet at a star like Betelgeuse, or indeed any star, you're basically seeing deeper into the star's atmosphere, because that's where it's hotter and where the light being emitted has got more energy. So what you're seeing here is a region of Betelgeuse's outer atmosphere where there's perhaps, indeed there's no need to say perhaps, you can see for yourself, it's vast, it's bigger not even just than the Earth, much, much bigger than the Earth, it's even bigger than the Earth's orbit. So if Betelgeuse was where our sun is, our planet would be swallowed up inside the star. And this is a feature that's, crossing about half the star's disk. And it's believed to be a kind of bubble that's coming up from deep inside the star, a convective bubble of hot gas, in roughly the same way as you get bubbles in a pan of boiling water that sort of bubble up towards the top. Again, more on that in a few weeks' time. But seeing deeper into the atmosphere, you can't do it from the ground. You can't look in ultraviolet light from the ground. You can't look in even shorter wavelengths called X-rays or gamma rays. So you need a space telescope for that. And even if you could, the trouble is the atmosphere is so shaky and produces this shimmering and twinkling effect that you wouldn't be able to see a star resolved as a disk. So these are all reasons why having Hubble was a good thing. But it's got to be a very, very big star in order for that to be possible. Even the nearest stars, Betelgeuse is a few hundred light years away. A light year is the distance that light travels in a year, about 10 million million kilometers. The very nearest star is only a few light years away. But most of the near stars to our own sun are quite similar in size to our own sun. So even with Hubble, they still just look like points of light. The reason why you can resolve Betelgeuse is because, well, it's not too far away. A few hundred light years sounds a lot, but compared with the size of our galaxy, it's relatively nearby. And also, Betelgeuse is huge. It's enormous. We don't believe that it was always this size. We believe that it's grown over the last few hundred million years, or a few tens of millions of years, because it's almost at the end of its life. And we'll develop that theme of stars, birth, and life and death in a few weeks' time. What happens when a star reaches the end of its life? That means when it's used up all the hydrogen gas that provides the fuel to give off heat and light. If it's a star like the Sun, it will turn into one of these, which is another type of object that's been photographed very beautifully with Hubble. This is called a planetary nebula. And what you see at the centre is a little object known as a white dwarf star, a very hot star that's the core of a regular star that existed there before. And the outer part of the star has been drifting off into space, and it contains a lot of chemical elements that we are made of. So as we'll see in a few weeks' time when we develop this theme more fully, we owe a great legacy to Hubble in helping us to understand the process by which stars are born, go through their life, in the process of which they actually manufacture chemical elements, and then at the end of their life, they return those chemical elements in this ultimate cosmic recycling process to the rest of the universe. They can do it in a fairly relaxed and not too dramatic fashion, like they see here, where the outer shell of that star is just slowly drifting off at a fairly pedestrian rate.
So this is a red giant remnant?
Yes, exactly. If it's a red supergiant remnant or a blue supergiant remnant, what's more likely to have happened is that it will have turned into a supernova. And Hubble's observed plenty of them too, but I don't think I've got any slides of the supernovae here. I've maybe got one a bit later, but we'll talk quite a lot about supernovae as well. in the weeks to come. Supernova is an exploding star. A planetary nebula is a star that reaches the end of its life without the explosion, but just a rather gradual dissipation. Back to stellar birth again. This is the Orion Nebula, which is essentially where the Sword of Orion is in the familiar constellation. And it's an image that looks quite good even from a ground-based telescope, but you don't get the detail, the colours and the contrast that you would get with Hubble. And looking deep into the Orion Nebula, Hubble has revealed evidence of new planetary systems forming. These are known for short as proplids, short for protoplanetary disks. And each of these is a star, maybe very much like our own sun, around which is a little disk, actually quite a large disk really, of gas and dust. And very probably, in those gas and dust disks, new planets are forming. And it will take a very long time before the dust clears and the planets kind of emerge from that protoplanetary disk. So unfortunately, we can't hang around and wait for that to happen. It will be a few million years, perhaps. But we're seeing a snapshot of a stage in the planet's formation that presumably our own planetary system went through when the Sun was formed. So we can learn something about how our own Earth formed, how the other planets in our own solar system formed. More on that to come. We've learned a lot about planets from Hubble. Most notably, we've learned that other stars have planets. And I'll be dropping the odd graph in here and there because it's not just all color photos. What this graph shows is the change in the brightness, what we call the relative flux, of a star as a planet passes in front of the star. It's what we call a transit. Now you can see transits of Venus and Mercury across our own sun. And they have an interesting historical significance because we used transits of Venus to work out how far away the sun was. We did all that more than two centuries ago. But nowadays, transiting planets are much more of interest if the planet is going around another star rather than our own solar system. And the planet is too faint to be observed directly, but we can tell it's there because of the effect it has on the background star. Instead of the brightness of the star being constant, it takes a wee dip when the planet begins to cross the star, and then the star gets brighter again when the planet moves away. And by studying the shape of curves like this, we can work out how big the planet is. We can even work out what its atmosphere contains. And I'll go through the details in weeks to come, but the punchline is that we found with Hubble a planet that seems to contain the gases oxygen and carbon. And what you see in the right-hand side is the kind of graphs that astronomers use to work out stuff like that. It's the field of physics that we call spectroscopy. And I can't do it justice in just a few seconds tonight. We'll devote a whole session to it. But it's an absolute goldmine of information, spectroscopy. We can use it to work out what stars and planets are made of without actually going there. Because this, for example, I forget the precise distance, but I think it's a star that's a few tens of light years away. There's no prospect, really, in any of our lifetimes, or even for hundreds of years, perhaps, that we'll be able to go to that star ourselves, or even send an unmanned probe to them. But we can learn things about the star and the planets that go around it just by studying the light that comes to us from those stars. And that, I think, is a very profound thing. Well, nothing's absolute in science, but I mean, that's really the name of the game, is to try to place as tight constraints as we can on these kind of questions. And certainly because Hubble is working at the frontier of science, there's a lot of questions it's been addressing where we're really not sure of what we're seeing. Absolutely. I'll develop this theme in due course, but what you can see here is a spike. Now that spike is in the place in the star's spectrum of light. The numbers along the bottom correspond to the wavelength, or if you like, the colour of the light. And the bigger the spike is, the more sure you are that it's really a feature in the star spectrum and not just some defect of your telescope. Likewise, if you look at this one, the previous slide, which is the transit, I mean, that's an absolutely beautiful curve. All the little red dots are observations that Hubble made, whereas the solid curve is a model that astronomers have developed to try and explain those observations. Now, I don't have one with me here tonight, but I'll show you in subsequent weeks. By contrast, the Hubble observations done from space are beautifully clean and very precise. If you try to do the same sort of thing from the ground, the points are, you know, the observed points are all over the place. It's very hard to tell if you're really detecting a planet or not. So in that sense, you know, I think the fair answer to give you is, you know, nothing's absolute in science, but a lot of the Hubble results are much, much more convincing than anything we can do from the ground. I mean, if this isn't a planet going in front of the star, goodness knows what else it is. But, it, you know, it fits the model so beautifully. Even the little curve that you see at the bottom here is because just a little bit of the planet has started to cover the star, and then the whole of it has. So the width of this feature lets you work out the planet's orbit as well. And then there are other techniques you can use to verify that there really is a planet there. Again, I'll go into those in subsequent weeks. It's sort of like a detective story, you know. Much of it is based on circumstantial evidence, but if you have enough of that, then you can build up a very solid case.
And then you'll be able to detect, if, for example, you're 100 light years away, mm-hmm. and looking back at that,
yep.
you then have a fingerprint of the Earth.
Well, absolutely. I think it's maybe a little premature to see that Hubble has done that. What you see here in the image of the planet, this is just a cartoon impression, and I'll go into much more of this in subsequent weeks, is the idea that what's actually happening is the planet is very, very close to the star. It's also quite a big planet. It's a bit like taking our planet Jupiter, which is 5 times further away from the Sun than the Earth is, and putting it where Mercury is, which is about, you know, only 40% of the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Indeed, we've coined a phrase for such planets. We call them hot Jupiters. And what that means is the planet's atmosphere will be kind of boiled away by the star because it's so much hotter. And what we think we're seeing is evidence of the atmosphere containing oxygen and carbon because of this process of spectroscopy. Let's say, forgive me if I don't say more about it tonight. It's just really to keep you coming for the subsequent weeks. But that detective story as to how we convince ourselves that these really are the spectral lines corresponding to those gases, you know, I'll explain the details of that. But it is, in those terms, therefore, if somebody had a powerful enough telescope and was 100 light years away and was looking towards our Sun, they could, in principle, detect those same chemicals in the atmosphere of our planet. That is, if you like, the holy grail of searching for extrasolar planets, is to look for one like the Earth, where there could be water and oxygen and carbon. We haven't found one yet. But part of the trouble is, our planet's quite small, and we're good at finding big planets close to their star, but if they're too close to the star, it'll be too hot for us. There still might be life, but we wouldn't really know what we're looking for. If you're looking for life like us, as they, you know, what was it Dr. McCoy used to say? Life, but not as we know it. If in the contrary, you're looking for life as we know it, then you've got to look for a planet that right now Hubble really wouldn't be able to see, but maybe bigger telescopes in the future will. Okay? Moving a bit further from home, and just this sort of, you know, intro session, this is a galaxy. It's a galaxy very much like what we think our own Milky Way galaxy looks like. A galaxy is a kind of collection of stars, a family of stars. The numbers of stars in question is almost mind-blowing. It's of order hundreds of millions, indeed even hundreds of billions in some of the biggest galaxies. And this one, this spiral galaxy, notice another M number, M74 is a very familiar name to all of us here, but this is Messier 74, and this is a spiral galaxy which was one of the chief targets of the Hubble telescope. Not just because it gives beautiful pictures, but because we could find stars in those spiral galaxies which have special properties. They're called Cepheid variable stars, and we'll talk more about those in a subsequent week as well. But an image like this one reveals detail that you just simply couldn't see from the ground. You can see little blobs of red, and those are believed to be clouds of hot hydrogen gas, which are regions where maybe new stars are being born. So just as you can look for new stars being born in our own galaxy, remember the Eagle Nebula picture, so-called pillars of creation, the green pillars, and then the Orion Nebula picture, they're in our own galaxy, they're fairly nearby. But here you're looking at an object that's millions of light years away, tens of millions of light years away, and yet we can still see signs of where stars are being born there as well. Moving even further away, we can see evidence of where galaxies have been interacting with each other. Again, you're getting a snapshot. You can't wait and see it happen before your eyes because the whole process takes millions of years. But you're seeing a snapshot where two galaxies are in the process of merging. And it's quite a violent process that, again, is likely to produce lots of new stars. Now, our own galaxy is going to merge with our nearest neighbour galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, in a few billion years. We make that prediction based on our understanding of how our galaxy is moving and how Andromeda is moving. None of us can stick around to see it happen. Actually, the consequences might not be too bad for whoever's still around on Earth, if anybody is, because galaxies are really mainly empty space, because they're just made of stars, and the distance between the stars is very great. And because we live quite far from the centre of our galaxy, what was it Douglas Adams said, the unfashionable end of the outward spiral arm? Consequently, most of the action happens in the cores of the galaxies. And what you're seeing in this case is that the spiral arms get kind of stretched out as the two merging galaxies interact with each other. That's just gravity that does that, pulling on the stars. But if you happen to be living on a planet going around one of those stars, by and large, you wouldn't really notice. But, you know, if you were an astronomer in such a planet, you would get a pretty spectacular view of what was going on in your next door neighbour. So the best we can do is look for that having happened in the past and see evidence of it with Hubble. We can't wait around and see it happen in our own Milky Way because we'd have to wait a very, very long time. But by looking at how it's happened in the past, we can learn something about the process of how galaxies merge, and actually we think that's got a lot to do with how they formed in the first place. Little things form first, many of them merge together, they make a big galaxy. We'll talk about that in weeks to come. Indeed, Hubble's been very good at giving us a kind of catalogue or a zoo of such objects. These are all images taken by Hubble of galaxies interacting with a neighbouring galaxy. And they've all got their own stories to tell. Sometimes it's a kind of head-on collision. Sometimes it's a bit more of a, a rather coquettish courtship where they, you know, pass by each other. We can deduce by studying how we see the snapshot, we can deduce that probably they've been interacting weekly with each other, not weekly in once per week, but weekly as in not strongly, over billions of years. They just never quite get it together and merge and collide. Whereas in other cases, it's like one galaxy kind of bullseyes the other. So all of that helps us to understand perhaps how our own galaxy could have formed. It helps to tell us something about what you find lurking at the centre of, we believe, virtually all galaxies, which is what we call a supermassive black hole. And Hubble has helped to find some of those. I think I've got a slide of that coming up. The further out in space you look, the further back in time you're looking. What was it? You know, the famous opening of Star Wars, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. That's exactly what Hubble is doing. As it looks at very distant galaxies, it's seeing them as they were billions of years ago. And sometimes nature gives us a bit of a helping hand. Because Hubble can see very far away because it's a telescope that focuses light. But nature can do that for itself. It can do it through a process that Robert referred to earlier. It's called gravitational lensing. And gravitational lensing means if you've got something even further away, the light from it can be focused and amplified by the presence of something in between that's sort of bending the light. It's not a piece of glass, it's matter in the universe. Because ever since Einstein, we've realised that light actually is affected by the presence of matter in the universe. It gets curved or bent the more mass there is. So gravitational lensing has become a very powerful and exciting new field in astronomy since I was a graduate student, and Hubble has made a big contribution there, and it's helped us to see things which are incredibly far away. The names and the labels won't mean so much at this stage, although they might to many of you if you've read or talked about this sort of thing before. The Z here stands for redshift, and later in the course we'll talk about what that means. But the bigger the redshift is, the further back in time you're looking. And this one, this little red smudge here, that we're seeing really just because the light has been amplified by the dark matter in between us and it. It's so far away that the light probably set off when the universe was only about 500 million years old. That's about 13 billion years ago. And we're seeing it now, thanks to Hubble. Now here's those supermassive black holes that I mentioned. Hubble has helped us to understand just what exactly is going on in the centre of galaxies. Quasars is short for quasi-stellar object. And quasars have been around for a long time. They were first observed in the 50s and 60s, but no one was really sure what they were. Although, by the late 70s, we had a pretty good idea, but the theory said that what quasars were was the core of a distant galaxy. And the core was so much brighter than the rest of the galaxy that until Hubble came along, we couldn't really see the rest of the galaxy. We could just see the very bright core. So what Hubble has allowed us to see is that quasars often are embedded in galaxies just like our own, you know, with a disk a bit like the Milky Way, or sometimes it can be two galaxies that are interacting with each other. And what we think is at the centre of all that is an object that's really weird. It's a black hole, so massive that even light can't escape. What you're seeing here is not the black hole itself, but the gas and dust surrounding it that's glowing very brightly because of the extreme gravity of the black hole. And many of these black holes at the cores of galaxies that Hubble has seen have masses millions of times greater than our own Sun. So you're concentrating an enormous amount of matter at the centre of the galaxy. That's going to affect how stars in the centre of the galaxy behave. It's maybe going to drag some of them in actually and get swallowed up, and all of that contributes to how galaxies form. And I think this is the last one of our kind of just initial series of snapshots to whet your appetite. This is one of the most distant images that Hubble took during its first few years. What they did was they found a patch of sky where there didn't seem to be many foreground stars, it just looked blank, and they just opened Hubble's shutter for a very long time. For hours and hours, indeed for several days, I think, if I remember correctly. And when the images were processed, this is what Hubble saw. It's the old idea that if you want to take a photo in low light conditions, you need a longer exposure. Or you need a flash, but that's not very practical when the things you're photographing are 13 billion light years away. So a very long exposure will bring out detail that you don't see from a short exposure. And that's what the Hubble Deep Field was aiming to do. It was aiming to go deep by observing and counting the photons of light for a very long time to let the image build up gradually. There's been a subsequent Hubble Ultra Deep Field that went even deeper, more on that in weeks to come, but they've helped to tell us something about those galaxies a long time ago and are far, far away, and many valuable clues as to how those galaxies formed have been supplied by the deep fields. So, we've had a wee taste of many of these. The solar system, things to do with stars, the searching for planets, and then a number of topics to do with cosmology. A few that I didn't really mention in my wee snapshots there. For the second half of tonight, what I'm going to do is talk about telescopes more generally. I might not get that finished tonight, but we'll come back to anything that I don't cover in a subsequent session. In a later week, we'll also talk about Hubble, Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble Space Telescope is named. I mean, that will kind of come up anyway under the topic mapping and measuring the universe, because one of the things that Hubble, the Hubble Telescope, was designed to do was to measure a number called the Hubble Constant, named after Edwin Hubble, and it measures how fast our universe is expanding. And if you didn't know our universe was expanding, then tune in a few weeks and you'll hear all about that. Now, obviously, as the weeks go on, the exact topics that we cover might change a little, and I'm very happy to respond to any questions throughout the session, but also any comments or requests, if you like, you know, for things that you'd like me to devote special attention to. So view it as a kind of work in progress. But my intention is that I'll put files with all the slides and any accompanying movies, I'll also put those on the web, although they'll generally be quite big files, on this website. So it's password protected, and that's the username and password. And assuming this experiment with recording myself works out, then there'll also be audio files there, if you want to listen again. Figure if the BBC can do it, then so can I. Okay, so, I suggest that we maybe stop briefly. It's just on about 8:30, and then we'll pick up the threads just in about 15 minutes after a brief break. Just before we break for coffee then, can I mention, if you didn't already know, that this year is the International Year of Astronomy. So anything that I don't manage to cover tonight, of course, in the normal scheme of things, I would just say, right, we'll tune in next week and we'll pick the story up again. But I'm actually off to the official conference to launch International Year of Astronomy, and I won't be back, well, it's a rather complicated trip. It's Paris and then Mumbai, and I won't get back until the 25th. So you won't see me again until Monday the 26th of January. So you've got Alec McKinnon next week. And rather than just, you know, dump some fresh slides on Alec, which he hadn't prepared, I said to Alec, well, you just talk about the solar system objects anyway, because that was his stated wish. And then if I haven't covered all of the slides tonight, then I'll just pick up, we'll sort of double back to a discussion of the telescope and the early years of Hubble after Alec's session next week. Okay? So, if you think all that sounds appealing, then we'll see you in about 15 minutes. And, see, the clock's not working in the side there. Well, I'll make that just on 8:30. Yep, that seems to be the only clock we have. But if we could maybe aim to start again about 9:15, and that will let us carry on with some more tonight. Okay? And I'll begin, after the coffee break, with a discussion of, you know, the very earliest telescopes all the way through to the concept of having a space telescope. Okay, thank you.